It is Friday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, world leaders express dismay at the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. A former official from the administration of President George W. Bush criticizes President Donald Trump.
A lot of the statistics that he used were just wrong. In fact, I think we're going to see an impact, a negative impact on jobs by this.
Britain gets ready for next week's parliamentary elections, and earthquake-prone Pacific Rim countries prepare for emergencies. It's all ahead. World leaders and environmental groups have expressed their disappointment with U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the landmark Paris Climate Accord, the global effort to deal with the effects of climate change. Trump said the United States was getting out of a deal he said imposed draconian burdens, costing billions of dollars and millions of U.S. jobs. He described the pact as very unfair to the United States and beneficial to other major polluters like China and India. International Edition's Lori London speaks with former head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, about President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords.
From the president's perspective, what he has said is that it will cost us jobs, that he's putting America first. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the statistics that he used were just wrong. In fact, I think we're going to see an impact, a negative impact on jobs by this, because trade sanctions work both ways. And when you have every other major industrialized country and every other really country, other than we're now in bed with Syria and with North Korea, Nicaragua. I'm not sure the company we want to keep. First of all, they're not going to renegotiate. This has taken a long time to get there. A lot of what he said was mandatory is not mandatory, and they're not about to sit down at the table to renegotiate this. They have already doubled down, and China has already reached out to the European Union saying, we want to continue this. We want to make sure this is real. We have left now a gap in leadership that is going to be filled by others. And I think that what you'll see, too, is some of the nations that are part of this and are going to stay there are going to say, you know what, you like trade wars? We're going to put a tariff, even if the businesses, because the sad thing is so many of our businesses have already taken major steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As a nation, we've done a very good job at this, actually, better than many who are part of the Paris Peace Accord. But we don't get credit for it because it's not mandatory. We do it voluntarily. But I don't think that other countries are going to care, and that even the countries that have set aggressive targets will find there'll be a tariff on imported goods. That's a potential, plus the fact that we lose our leadership, which is what excites the next level of innovation, seems at any level, and this is also sending a signal we don't really believe in science. Young minds that want to engage in this kind of thing and cutting-edge technology, the new things that bring new jobs, are going to go elsewhere. They're not going to stay here if they don't think science is deemed important and they don't think that basic research will be funded.
Do you think that's what comes next, that we lose on those accounts?
I think that's a real possibility. Maybe I'm overstating, but I think it is a real possibility. We already see, I know, in many of the companies several companies with which I've been involved, the millennials, when they come in to do a job interview, one of the first things they ask is, what is your commitment to the environment? What are you doing on greenhouse gases? They care about this. And so I can see them saying, or conversely, we won't bring in some of the best minds that we have been bringing in to study here. And then they stay here, except when we throw them out, which we're now doing more and more. We're going to see them not want to come here because this is not going to be the place where that cutting edge research is being done. And we lose when that happens.
Does this mean the EPA will no longer regulate greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I mean, I think we all knew that this was going to, that they weren't going to be very aggressive in their regulations anyway. Enforcement's being cut. President's budget proposal. Budgets to me were, as a governor, when I put budgets forward, EPA, when I put a budget forward, it was a policy duck. It's where you really think the issues lie and what you really want to address. And the way this administration's budget was proposed, with a 31% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency, that's kind of telling you they don't think much of it. And they're not going to be doing much. And the president said he loves the environment. He wants a clean, green environment. He was saying how well we've done. Well, we have. And if you think about it, between 1990 and 2008, we saw the population in this country grow by 30%. We saw our electricity demand, our energy demands, increase by 35%. Our real GDP more than doubled. And yet we were able to reduce the 6 criteria pollutants by over 67%. So this idea that you cannot have a clean and green environment and a healthy, thriving economy is just wrong. That's the wrong way to keep posing these issues. And yet that's what he did in very strong terms.
So ultimately, what does this mean for the planet?
Well, the good news for the environment is, first of all, the rest of the world appears to be willing to continue to go forward. And we have a number of major companies that have set aggressive goals. We have states that have entered into compacts, the Western governors, Reggie in the Northeast. And we have a number of our major cities who have set goals for themselves. So they're going to continue to do that. They may just double down after the United States taking itself out. I just worry that we've created this void in international leadership on this issue, and it seems on several others, and that's going to not necessarily be filled by people who have our best interests at heart.
And that was my next question, is what does it mean for our global relationships?
Well, we're certainly straining them. Again, Trump scolded NATO for the countries for not spending what he thought they ought to spend, and he makes it sound as if there's actual a dollar figure they're supposed to put in. It's 2% of their overall budget. And really, the legal requirement is that you do that when there is a collective or when one of the countries or the signatories are in trouble.
Fareed Zakaria just said that the U.S., this move has made the U.S. no longer the leader of the free world.
Well, it certainly has reduced us. I mean, people aren't looking at us that way anymore. Russia is just loving this, and I think we are ceding that position. It seems that the president doesn't really care. He was talking about how people no longer laugh at it. I think that's just the opposite is happening. People that I have talked to overseas are just befuddled. They say, what is going on? What's happened with the United States? We need a strong United States. We rely on a strong United States. People need to understand that climate change is a national security issue for us. Because when you have these problems, see, we're an Arctic nation. When the Bering Sea opens up, you have Russian trawlers, Chinese trawlers. There are up there, and we don't have the presence to push back. We're not going to be at the table to negotiate things. I think we very definitely are ceding our leadership position. People aren't going to look to us in the same way that they did before. And when you think of what's happening in, for instance, in the sub-Sahara Africa, where you have very severe droughts, you have nomadic people who can no longer live off the land. They can't keep their herds alive. There's no water. They're moving into cities and towns that don't have jobs for them. Those are perfect recruiting areas for ISIL and Al-Qaeda. And we've got to understand all the ramifications for this, and it hits us in so many different ways. 200,000 Americans die every year because of dirty airborne issues, related issues. 200,000. So let's just talk about cleaning up our air, because guess what? Carbon is a pollutant. Mercury is a pollutant. What we're spewing out are not good for our health. Asthma, childhood asthma, all the heart disease, lung cancer, emphysema, all those things are exacerbated by bad air quality. So let's just clean up the air, and that would help us with climate change.
Christine Todd Whitman, a member of President Trump's Republican Party. She was head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency during the administration of President George W. Bush. Before that, she was governor of the state of New Jersey. She spoke with my colleague, Lori London. Well, meanwhile, leading scientific organizations say evidence clearly shows the world's climate is changing and urgent measures must be taken to slow the warming of the planet. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The organizations say the scientific evidence is clear that human activity is behind the changing climate. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is an independent scientific assessment body. It warns without additional mitigation efforts beyond those already in place, warming by the end of the century will lead to very high risk of severe, widespread, and irreversible impacts. IPCC spokesman Jonathan Lynn says the scientific body finds that limiting climate change would require substantial and sustained reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, which together with adaptation, can limit climate change risks.
In its analysis of decision-making to limit climate change and its effects, the IPCC noted that climate change is a problem of the commons, requiring collective action at the global scale. Effective mitigation will not be achieved if individual players advance their own interests independently. It is not clear at this stage how the US withdrawal from the Paris Agreement will affect future emissions.
Dion Terre-Blanche heads the Atmospheric Research and Environment Department at the World Meteorological Organization. He says global warming will continue for as long as the world emits greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere.
Even a reduction in the emissions will not lead to a reduction in the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere because there's a cumulative effect and CO2 remains in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. The climate will continue to warm in any case.
In a worst-case scenario, He warns the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement could result in an additional warming of the atmosphere of 0.3 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's the reaction to some of this?
It's across-the-board reaction. Lots of people very upset with this decision. And the interesting thing about that reaction is that it's an odd mix of environmental activists who you would expect to be unhappy and big business titans who are not necessarily the most friendly folks to the environment sometimes, but they say that pulling out of the deal hurts their companies, hurts jobs. And three in particular using social media to express their displeasure. Robert Iger, the chairman and CEO of Walt Disney, tweeting out that as a matter of principle, he's resigned from the president's council over the Paris Agreement withdrawal. Then you have Elon Musk, who's the founder of Tesla and SpaceX. He tweeted out that he's departing the presidential councils. Climate change is real. Leaving Paris is not good for America or the world. And this one is perhaps the most interesting. Lloyd Blankfein, he's the CEO of investment bank Goldman Sachs. He's had a Twitter account since June 2011, but he's never tweeted until yesterday, tweeting for the first time ever about this Paris Accord, saying today's decision is a setback for the environment and for the U.S.'s leadership position in the world. So very strong words from those three business leaders on social media. The other big trending story today, in addition to the Paris Accord, which people continue to talk about today, is hashtag wear orange. People are wearing orange to mark gun violence awareness day. So you're seeing lots of activists using social media to share statistics about gun crimes. And particularly poignant, you're seeing a lot of stories from people who have lost family members to gun crimes or even victims of gun crimes. And among them, former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was shot in the head at a campaign appearance but survived, tweeting out that she and her husband, astronaut Mark Kelly, are wearing orange because stopping gun violence takes courage and we're not giving up. So very strong words from one of the most famous gun violence survivors in the U.S.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories we're following. Terror concerns scuttle international cricket matches in Pakistan. The White House may return diplomatic compounds seized from Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin urges U.S. business executives to help strengthen U.S.-Russia ties. And the United Nations says Iran is complying with the nuclear deal. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition. Next Thursday, British voters go to the polls for parliamentary elections. The vote follows last year's controversial referendum on Brexit, when British voters decided to leave the European Union by a narrow margin. British Prime Minister Theresa May called the election on April 18th, when polls suggested her Conservative Party commanded a substantial lead over the second largest party, Labour, which is headed by Jeremy Corbyn. But since then, the polls have tightened. VOA's Carol Castiel interviewed two British journalists, Toby Harnden, the Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times of London, and James Astle, Washington correspondent for The Economist. She asked Harnden to explain May's thinking to call these snap elections in the first place.
Well, I think she wanted to increase her parliamentary majority. She had a majority of, I think, 17. And going into the EU negotiations, she wanted to have more flexibility, not to be beholden to a small number of MPs, maybe on the hardline Brexit side, who might have sort of limited her room for manoeuvre. But it's one of those cases, a bit like David Cameron, be careful what you ask for, because it looks like at the moment that strategy may be backfiring.
Because she is not as high in the polls as
well,
she thought.
Well, she was about 21 points ahead coming in, and it was always natural that would come down. But there are some polls now that are putting it as close as 3 percentage points ahead. I mean, I think it's still a fairly faint possibility, but there could be a hung parliament where she has no absolute majority, in which she would be in the worst possible negotiating position.
James Astle, turning to you, anything to add or subtract to why Theresa May called these elections and where she stands in the polls to date?
No, I think Toby's absolutely bang on, but I mean, I just underline that Theresa May became prime minister after the trauma of the Brexit vote with an extraordinary kind of fair wind behind her. She was not well known in the country, though she was a veteran Tory politician who'd held important jobs in the cabinet, had been around for a long time. She seemed a reassuring presence, and she made a number of sensible moves as she became Prime Minister. She talked about reconnecting the party, which had been previously run under David Cameron, by well-educated, cosmopolitan, very metropolitan elite figures, reconnecting it to the sort of middle England voter that the Tory party had traditionally relied upon. And this went down extremely well. But what this current election campaign has done really is it mostly exposed what a mediocre politician Theresa May is. She is not in command of the wide array of government policy. Her understanding of business and economics seem to be particularly poor. She's not sure-footed. She's not confident of her brief. And she's not a terribly attractive or charismatic figure either. So I think that that slide in the polls, that closing of the gap in the polls between Labour and the Tories that Toby referred to, is really a natural adjustment as voters come to terms with the fact that they knew the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and they didn't think very much of him. They didn't actually know the Prime Minister terribly well, and it turns out they don't think much of her either.
James Astill, Washington correspondent for The Economist, and Toby Harnden, the Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times of London. They spoke to VOA's Carol Castiel for Encounter. Listen to Encounter on voanews.com or this weekend on VOA. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. Earthquakes are a fact of life in Pacific Rim countries, but most are small shocks that don't do much damage. But a major quake, one registering more than 6.0 on the open-ended Richter scale, can devastate communities, even those that have prepared for disaster. In many urban centers around the Pacific Rim, it could be weeks or a month or more before water service gets restored after a major earthquake, not to mention electricity, sewage, and fuel supplies as well. Correspondent Tom Bensey reports on the cost-benefit choices leaders are making on both sides of the Pacific.
Japan has a deserved reputation as one of the best-prepared countries in the world for earthquakes. But even there, quakes can cause massive and lasting damage. You may recall a big earthquake struck Kobe, Japan, in 1995.
It's also hard to fathom why, here in one of the most developed parts of the world, firemen are slowed down because the water supply has been cut off.
The magnitude 6.9 quake knocked out water and electricity, collapsed a main highway and railway, and killed more than 6,000 people. Kobe is now in the process of replacing nearly 4,800 kilometers of cast iron water distribution lines with flexible pipe to make its system earthquake resistant. Hitoshi Araike is an assistant manager at the city's Waterworks Bureau.
I guess that the damage we have received in the earthquake kind of determined that we will replace the pipes.
Araike and an interpreter led foreign journalists deep underground to see a new large transmission main that can double as emergency water storage. It cost more than $300 million. He described automatic shutoff valves installed at reservoirs to keep water from draining away after a quake. And he showed the flexible pipes and new-style connectors with reinforced sleeves that resist breakage. They're being deployed at both the waterworks and a rebuilt sewage treatment plant. I asked Araike how long water service might be out in his city after the next great earthquake.
Once the new technology is in place, I expect zero disruption.
Zero disruption?
Other Pacific Rim countries with memories of great earthquakes are investing in seismic strengthening, notably Chile, Taiwan, China, and New Zealand. However, it takes a long time and a lot of money to make a difference at the city or regional level. Lack of resources or lack of building code enforcement can be a barrier in less developed countries, such as Pakistan or Cambodia. A big public utility on the U.S. West Coast also has an ambitious earthquake resilience goal.
We'd like to get back up and operating within 3 to 4 days. That's our goal from a level of service standpoint.
Jim Miller is the engineering superintendent for Everett, Washington's Public Works Department. I spoke with him as contractors were reinforcing walls and ceilings to earthquake-proof the operations building at the city's drinking water treatment plant. It serves 600,000 people north of Seattle. Miller says his utility assessed its earthquake vulnerability and has prioritized a list of seismic upgrades that could take 20 years and many millions of dollars to complete. City residents would have to cover that cost with higher water bills.
If we did nothing, that's more, you know, business as usual. And so you could keep rates lower. But people we've found, for the most part, expect a reliable system. And once they understand what it's for, they seem, in fact, our wholesale customers have actually encouraged us to make our system more resilient.
A regional water supply group for the greater Seattle area recently estimated outage times for a big offshore earthquake and close by shallow ones. Their analysis found it currently could take up to 60 days to restore service to most customers. Those projections for long outages of vital services mean residents need to prepare to survive on their own. State and federal emergency managers used to recommend stockpiling food and water and medicines for 3 days. Now, Oregon and Washington states suggest people in earthquake country prepare a kit with 2 weeks' worth of disaster supplies. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Everett, Washington.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria has accelerated, said U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. In an interview with CBS News, Mr. Mattis said the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition has shifted from what he called attrition tactics, where ISIS terrorists are pushed from one position to another, to annihilation tactics, where the terrorists are surrounded and destroyed. Our intention is that the foreign fighters do not survive the fight to return home to North Africa, to Europe, to America, to Asia, to Africa, said Secretary Mattis. We are not going to allow them to do so. We are going to stop them there and take apart the caliphate. Secretary Mattis noted that while the tactics and the tempo of the anti-ISIS fight have shifted, there has not been a change in the rules of engagement. There is no relaxation of our intention to protect the innocent, he said. We do everything we can to protect the civilians. Defense Secretary Mattis said there is no question but that ISIS is going to go down. But he emphasized the fight involves more than just an army. It is also a fight about ideas. We have got to dry up their recruiting. We have to dry up their fundraising. The way we intend to do it is to humiliate them, to divorce them from any nation giving them protection and humiliating their message of hatred, of violence. Anyone who kills women and children is not devout, Secretary Mattis said. We're going to strip them of any kind of legitimacy. Secretary Mattis warned that while there is no question the coalition will shatter ISIS's sense of invincibility in their physical caliphate, we are going to watch for other organizations growing up. We are going to have to continue to keep the pressure on the enemy. There is no room for complacency on this. Complacency, no. Conviction, yes. Asked what keeps him awake at night, Secretary of Defense Mattis answered, "Nothing. I keep other people awake at night."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.